This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, April 20th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marino. Coming up, a new investigation into the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico finds a cover-up of a similar accident 2 years earlier in the Caspian Sea. We'll get the details and go to the Gulf Coast to hear how residents are rebuilding their communities. As the Constitution Party selects their presidential nominee, we'll look at conservative efforts to implement immigration reform. And in France, a former socialist leader is drawing attention to big banks, corruption, and austerity measures ahead of this weekend's presidential vote. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Planned Parenthood has stopped all prescription drug-induced abortions in Wisconsin after a new law took effect today. FSRN's Molly Stentz has the story from Madison.
The law was designed to outlaw webcam abortions and mandate that a doctor be present in the room with the patient for the procedure. But Planned Parenthood says the law is so broad and vague that it essentially criminalizes abortions induced by prescription drugs as well. State Representative Chris Taylor says that Republicans in Wisconsin won't stop until they outlaw abortion.
So this is not about women's health. I mean, they don't really care about women's health. This is about making sure abortion is as inaccessible as possible.
Planned Parenthood says the new law puts their doctors at risk for felony criminal penalties. The group has said they will continue to offer surgical abortions and that the use of the morning after pill will not be affected by the law. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
A judge in Florida has granted George Zimmerman $150,000 bail. Zimmerman is accused of shooting and killing Trayvon Martin last month in Sanford, Florida. In court today, Zimmerman addressed Martin's family.
I wanted to say I am sorry for the loss of your son. I did not know how old he was. I thought he was a little bit younger than I am, and I did not know if he was armed or not.
A photo published by ABC allegedly shows Zimmerman a few minutes after the shooting with blood on the back of his head. This could prove important in substantiating Zimmerman's claim that the teenager and he were in a physical altercation before the shooting. Faith communities in St. Petersburg, Florida, ended a march at a downtown Publix today, calling on the supermarket chain to pay immigrant farm workers a fair wage. For FSRN, Atisha Robinson reports.
The prayer vigil, organized out of a local evangelical social justice conference, was joined by members of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Both groups once again asked the multi-million dollar company to join the Fair Food Campaign, in which large food chains agree to pay one penny more per pound of food picked by immigrants. As Publix consumers watched on, evangelical leader Brian McLaren said he hoped the disagreement would not lead to a boycott.
What's interesting is other grocers are starting to come on board, and so the options will be there for customers if they decide, you know, we'd rather shop somewhere that takes their ethical responsibility to the harvesters and, in a sense, takes their moral responsibility to their customers more seriously.
Publix managers surrounded the protesters but did not interrupt the prayers. They did call the police, who asked the protesters to leave. Atisha Robinson, FSRN, St. Petersburg.
By a large majority of votes, the European Union has agreed to share information about airline passengers with the United States. Thursday's passenger name record agreement covers travelers from the EU to the U.S. Proponents of the agreement say that it's necessary to fight terrorism and crime. However, critics say the privacy of EU citizens will be compromised. FSRN's Cinnamon Napard has more from Berlin.
Passenger name record data includes basic information like name, address, phone number, credit card details, baggage information, and seat number. But it may also include so-called sensitive data, such as racial origin, political opinions, religious or philosophical beliefs, trade union membership, health, or sexual orientation. Under the agreement, the data will be depersonalized after 6 months, which means the passenger's name will be masked out. Access will be further limited as the years pass, but even after a decade, U.S. law enforcement will still be able to use the information in certain situations. The U.S. government threatened to end visa-free travel to the U.S. for EU citizens if the agreement did not pass. Thursday's deal will replace a controversial 2007 agreement between the EU and the US and will apply for 7 years. Cinema Nippard, FSRN, Germany.
News that a Thai company plans to press ahead with construction of a $3.5 billion hydroelectric dam in Laos has triggered threats by Cambodia to take Laos to international court. FSRN's Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok.
The Cambodian threat follows moves by Thai construction firm Ko Kan Chang to go ahead with the Zaya Berry Dam project in Laos, despite an agreement last December by Mekong River countries to delay construction until further environmental impact assessments could be carried out. Amy Trandum is with the environmental group International Rivers.
So this has been seen as a move that they are actually planning to start construction of the dam itself. Now, that violates international law because it is violating the 1995 Mekong Agreement.
There are concerns about the impact the dam would have on the river's lower reaches, especially in the rice-growing regions of Vietnam. The Zaya Berry Dam is just one of 11 dam projects planned for the river. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Today marks the 2-year anniversary of the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. In a moment, we'll go to the Gulf Coast to hear how local residents are working to rebuild their communities. But first, we look at a new investigation by journalist Greg Pallast and EcoWatch that has found that the oil company BP and the U.S. government had been alerted to the risks of a blowout to a well before 2010. That's because 2 years earlier, there was another explosion on a BP rig in the Caspian Sea. According to the investigation, BP tried to downplay the explosion and cover it up. For more of the details on this new investigation, we're joined by journalist Greg Pallast. Welcome to FSRN.
Glad to be with you.
Why did you go to the Caspian Sea, and what did you find there?
After the Deepwater Horizon exploded in the Gulf of Mexico 2 years ago today, I got a cable from the Caspian Sea on the other side of the world saying, this is not the first blowout on a BP offshore rig, that they had a previous blowout, as it turns out. In fact, actually, the witness... This is an eyewitness from inside the industry who couldn't even send me the message in email. I got a secure line. He said, this is not the first time. They had a blowout, and it turns out, for the same exact reasons as the Deepwater Horizon blowout, in both cases, a money-saving procedure using quick-dry cement failed in both the Caspian Sea and the Gulf. That's the accusation. That's really serious because that turns the Gulf disaster from an accident into a homicide, negligent homicide. So for British television, I went undercover into Baku, Azerbaijan, on the Caspian Sea to find witnesses to confirm whether BP had a blowout 2 years before the Deepwater Horizon. And indeed, I found two witnesses there, so that was now three witnesses to a blowout and the failure of the cement, which BP had concealed from the industry, from the U.S. regulators, U.S. Securities Exchange Commission, the British government. It was all covered up, and because it was covered up, they didn't change their methods. They continued to use the money-saving quick dry cement, and 11 men died. I went to Azerbaijan for that purpose, and by the way, I was arrested there in the middle of the investigation.
And talk more about that. You said when you first arrived, you and your crew were met with authorities there and arrested. What happened?
Well, we found out that BP was tipped off to our investigation of the blowout, and apparently that information got to the Azerbaijan authorities. But then our entire story ended up being confirmed from an extraordinary source, which is the U.S. State Department cables, the Manning WikiLeaks cables, which we found out that the Bush administration knew all about the BP blowout in 2008 and covered it up.
Well, so not only are there the questions about what BP knew and its failure to report this, the full details of this accident in 2008 in the Caspian Sea, but there's these WikiLeaks cables as well. What do these cables say about what the U.S. government knew and when?
Well, it was quite extraordinary, stunning. What we found is in the WikiLeaks cables, we discovered that the president of BP Azerbaijan went to the U.S. embassy and explained that there was a disastrous blowout, that they were lucky that the whole thing didn't blow up and incinerate 200 people, that there was mud, as they call it, which is the drilling cement, all over the deck, and methane. And they were explaining to the U.S. embassy what happened, and they were doing so because the U.S. embassy had complained to BP at the request of BP's junior partners in the Caspian, Chevron and Exxon. So this gets, unfortunately, the conspiracy gets a little bit wider, because not only did BP know and cover it up, so did the Bush administration, and so did Exxon, and so did Chevron.
So you have this evidence of this blowout, which was mischaracterized before. It wasn't reported correctly in 2008. Industry knew about it. The WikiLeaks cables show that the U.S. government had knowledge. What's the significance of that for the 2010 Deepwater Horizon explosion, as we're finding out more about what happened then and the responsibility of BP in that accident?
The connection is sad and terrible, which is that the exact same thing that led to the deaths, to the killings in the Gulf of Mexico, were the exact same causes as the blowout in the Caspian. So if we had known about the problem with using this so-called quick dry cement in the Caspian, it would not have been used in the Gulf. Those 11 men would be alive today, and the worst spill in U.S. history would never have occurred.
Journalist Greg Pallas spoke to us about his investigation with EcoWatch and dispatches into the BP explosion in 2008 in the Caspian Sea. You can find a link to the project and the video of the findings of the investigation at FSRN.org. Greg Pallas, thank you for joining us.
Terrific. Glad to be with you again.
While questions about BP's conduct before and after the oil spill persist, residents along the coast continue the recovery in their communities. Louisiana, the state hit hardest by oil from the spill, was already experiencing a crisis because of land loss to the Gulf. 2 years later, environmental advocates are rebuilding the ecosystem and hope a federal measure allocating oil spill fines to the region will be used in coastal restoration. FSRN's Zoe Sullivan has more from New Orleans.
That we can see the slump block is probably 1 to 2 meters wide, depending on where you're looking, and maybe
in Louisiana's Barataria Bay, so coastal scientist Alex Coker monitors the wetlands to see where land is being lost and where, if at all, it's being made.
Marshes do provide a buffer between the land and the sea, and as we have lost that buffer here in South Louisiana, the communities have become more vulnerable to storms, which was made oh too apparent in 2005.
Even before the oil spill, Louisiana was losing land at a rate of roughly 25 to 35 square miles a year. This is one reason politicians from across the South are supporting the Restore Act, which would allocate 80% of the fines levied against BP and other responsible parties to Gulf Coast restoration. The act is attached to the transportation bill, which passed the House on Wednesday and will now go to conference with the Senate version. Environmental advocates, like SINSAR2 of the Gulf Restoration Network, want the bill to become law.
I think the Restore Act, although it's not a perfect vehicle, is probably the only vehicle we have right now that would allow us to take most of the money and put it to Gulf restoration.
SAR2 and other advocates say that the states might have too much discretion about where to spend money. Some want to keep a close eye on these funds to ensure that they go into environmental projects and not things like convention centers.
I'm Captain Ryan Lambert, president of Cajun Fishing Adventures.
Ryan Lambert says he's seen his business nosedive since the BP disaster, But, he says, the spill only added salt to an open wound.
Well, right now, we're losing a vast majority of our economy in the fishing industry, the charter industry, the shrimp. You know, sooner or later, if it keeps going like it's going, the coastal erosion is going to collapse our ecosystem. Some places already might have collapsed. And if it does so, we're going to lose a major part of our income and our culture.
After Hurricane Katrina and the oil spill, many Louisianans agree there's an urgency to restoring the coast. As a result, although cuts to education have shrunk college programs, strong interest in coastal restoration has prompted one institution to approve a new associate's degree in the field. Klaus Heyer is an assistant professor at Nunez Community College. He supervises a certificate program in wetland science at this two-year college outside of New Orleans, which is directly across the street from one wetland area and two blocks from another.
They will learn water sampling techniques. They will have a good idea of the topography of the area. They will understand, you know, the historical attributes of the wetlands.
Heyer says fisher folk enrolled in the wetlands program after the oil spill, both because their industry was hurting, but also because it would help them to help revive the local environment that has sustained fishing families for generations. For Heyer, restoring the coast has clear benefits.
It's going to increase the number and the type of fish that you have in the area. So that's going to increase. Oysters, for example. You know, one of the projects that we want to work on involves using oyster beds to slowly reclaim the coast. And then we'll plant this reed that I was talking about earlier behind that. And then we'll bring the oyster beds out a little further.
While Heyer comes up with strategies for rebuilding land, others implement those strategies. Margot Moss works for an environmental consulting firm based in Baton Rouge.
I love working in the environmental field. I mean, I half the time I'm in the office doing very technical, doing write-ups, doing data analysis. The other half, I'm, you know, way out in the middle of nowhere on these islands and that no one ever goes to, watching baby chicks being born and, you know, getting to do field work and be outside. So it's a good balance in a lot of ways.
If the Restore Act does become law, a substantial amount of money would come to Louisiana. This could stimulate enrollment in Heyer's program, since it provides relatively quick, practical training. And many here hope it really will restore the wildlife that depends on this unique habitat. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
Each weekday, FSRN brings you stories from communities around the globe. We've helped spread grassroots voices for more than a decade with support from listeners like you. The power of the grassroots is the power of you, and only you can power FSRN. Check out our website at fsrn.org to find out how. As the 2012 election season intensifies, dueling wings of the fractured conservative base are putting forward various immigration proposals. While some are an effort to appeal to the growing Latino voting population, others are courting anti-immigrant nationalists. The proposals follow efforts by numerous states to pass their own harsh immigration enforcement bills, some of which are being challenged in court. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
In Nashville this weekend, Constitution Party members will select their candidate for president, and a key topic on their platform is immigration. The party is calling for a moratorium on all immigration, except in cases of extreme hardship. They also support stationing the military on U.S. borders and revoking the citizenship of U.S.-born children of undocumented parents. Washington State talk show host Lori Roth is one of the candidates seeking the nomination of the party at this week's convention. At a recent debate, she outlined her immigration plan.
I'm passionate about border security. We see criminals, mystery people, God knows what, terrorist weapons are coming across the border, let alone drugs. We have to stop it. Then we can do what is compassionate, responsible, and honorable and legal with the millions of illegals that are here.
Roth named the founder and the current head of the border vigilante group, the Minutemen, as her endorsers and advisors on immigration issues. Some conservative state legislators with similar views on immigration have succeeded in approving harsh enforcement laws and now face legal challenges from human rights advocates and the federal government. Nearly a year after passing the farthest-reaching immigration law in the country, HB 56, Alabama's House of Representatives voted Thursday to make several changes to the law, overcoming a two-hour filibuster from the Democrat minority. The new bill, now headed for the state Senate, increases the penalty for hiring an undocumented worker, allows police to demand papers both from drivers and passengers during traffic stops, and requires the superintendent of education to report on the cost of educating undocumented children in the state. Luis Robledo with the Hispanic Interest Coalition of Alabama says these aren't the sort of changes the Latino community has been calling for.
It makes it easier to defend in court and makes it easier to implement. And it makes no effort whatsoever to alleviate the suffering of Alabama families.
Since the passage of the original law last year, immigrant rights groups, unions, faith-based organizations, and civil rights advocates have been pushing for a bill to repeal it. That bill is still stuck in committee. Victor Palafox, an undocumented student and activist in Birmingham, says watching the House pass a bill to strengthen SB 56 felt like a slap in the face.
It almost is a type of PTSD when it comes to this, because I remember when HB 56 was moving up the committee, then the House, and the other committee, then the Senate, and then signed by the governor, and just feeling that sense of helplessness is all coming back again. And so this time, it's actually even worse because we've been fighting. And so for the legislature to just buckle down on this, it is a sense of betrayal.
Alabama's Republican leadership has defended the law by pointing to the inaction of the federal government on immigration reform. Over the last several years, many bills have died in Congress as the Republican Party struggled to balance the harsh enforcement rhetoric of the Tea Party base with the political necessity of courting Latino voters. Now, Florida Republican Marco Rubio, one of the most high-profile Latino conservatives in the country, is promoting his own version of the Democrats' DREAM Act, a plan to provide a path to citizenship for undocumented youth who complete college or military service. Earlier this month, Rubio described his vision to a reporter with Florida's conservative blog, The Shark Tank.
We're going to try to do an alternative to it that helps accommodate these kids, as I said consistently during the campaign, but not do it in a way that encourages illegal immigration or rewards illegal immigration.
Rubio's plan, which he has not yet introduced as a bill, does not have a citizenship option, but it would give undocumented youth temporary non-immigrant visas that would have to be periodically renewed. It would only apply to students already in the U.S., not to any brought by their parents in the future. Other Republicans have suggested a DREAM Act that only applies to those who join the military, but the National Immigration Forum and other rights groups have called this idea coercive, saying risking one's life should not be the only path to legalization. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
French voters go to the polls Sunday to choose which two candidates out of a field of 10 will face off in the final presidential election on May 6th. Center-right President Nicolas Sarkozy and Socialist Party candidate François Hollande are widely expected to advance in the final round. But a far-left movement led by a charismatic former socialist leader is surging in popularity. From France, FSRN's Leah Moriarty looks at the unlikely campaign of the candidate who describes himself as the sound and the fury.
No one has ever accused Jean-Luc Mélenchon of being timid.
Je suis le candidat!
I am the candidate of the resistance of the French people. To the credit rating agencies, to capital, to finance, I defy them. I laugh at them. We're going to hit them, and hit them again.
In an election where nearly a third of French voters told pollsters they may not vote because they can't get excited about either mainstream candidate, Mélenchon has held rallies attracting tens of thousands of red flag-waving supporters in cities across France. And while President Nicolas Sarkozy and his socialist challenger François Hollande trade barbs over security and immigration, Mélenchon fiercely channels the anger of workers, retirees, families, and young people struggling with high unemployment and shrinking government services in an era of globalization and tightening austerity. Standing behind a lectern emblazoned with his slogan, Prenez le pouvoir, or Take the Power, Mélenchon told supporters the rich must share more of their wealth with the rest of society.
Ils vont partager.
They will share. They will share. They will share either by agreement or by force. They will share by the force of the law.
Ils partageront par la force de la loi.
Among Mélenchon's proposals is a 100% tax on income over $475,000 a year. He promises to substantially boost the minimum wage and to forbid profitable companies from laying off workers. He also vows to reject the new European Union fiscal pact that binds countries to strict budget discipline. One young Mélenchon supporter explained to Euronews TV why she and her friends back him.
We're fed up with this soft left, which in the end isn't going to change much. And for us, Mélenchon has something that François Hollande will never have. He's got the drive, wants to change things, and down to the roots, not just superficially.
A former socialist senator and government minister, Mélenchon broke from his party by publicly opposing the 2005 EU constitutional treaty that French voters later rejected. He's currently a member of the European Parliament, a body he ridicules as powerless. This unapologetic hard-left movement has startled the political establishment. The Communist Party is the largest portion of Mélenchon's Front de Gauche, or Left Front, which has jumped from 5% popularity to as much as 17% in recent polls. The Left Front could be in position to overtake the extreme-right National Front as the main third party in French politics. Philip Golub, a political science professor at the American University of Paris, says Mélenchon has hit on a previously ignored vein of discontent with the rightward shift of politics in France and much of Europe since the mid-1990s.
In crystallizing that sentiment of opposition that was pretty much incohate before that, he has been galvanizing parts of society that for a long time were actually not mobilized, that were demobilized and demoralized, and that were on the edges of society.
In recent years, some French people feeling the pinch of a slumping economy and the erosion of the welfare state have gravitated to the right-wing National Front led by Marine Le Pen. Le Pen has downplayed the racist and anti-Semitic elements of the party her father Jean-Marie founded in the early 1970s. Instead, Le Pen stresses populist themes that appeal to voters who feel marginalized by elites in Paris, but who also don't identify with anti-immigrant and other far-right platforms. Professor Golub says the emergence of an alternative on the left may pull some of those voters away from Le Pen.
On both sides of the spectrum, you have about 30% of the electorate, perhaps a little bit more, that is going to vote quite radically against existing policies and policy frameworks.
Golub sees a similar dynamic arising in other European countries, especially Greece, Italy, and Spain, where austerity policies are increasingly meeting resistance and leftist parties are gaining ground. Mélenchon's critics dismiss his economic policies as a nostalgic throwback to the 1980s, saying he ignores the realities of a globalized 21st century. But Mélenchon says his aim is to create a government that serves the social good, not the powerful.
We can no longer support this selfish and cruel society that allows 2 million homes to remain empty when so many people, women and children, families, sleep in the streets.
Mélenchon knows he has no chance of making the runoff election and has said he'll urge his supporters to vote for François Hollande in the second round. While Mélenchon denies striking a deal in exchange for a post in an Hollande administration, it's expected Hollande would appoint at least a few left-front members to his government. But now that Mélenchon has re-energized a long-sleeping French left, it's unlikely he'll go quietly away after the election. And a President Hollande may well find himself a target of Mélenchon's sound and fury. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kamp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. And remember, the power of the grassroots comes from the power of listeners like you. We depend on a community to bring global voices to the air each and every day. Find out how you can support grassroots journalism at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.